for tapes, CDs, DVDs, to our publication, Voices from His Excellent Glory, Declaring the Kingdom, write P.O. Box 21516, Hot Springs, Arkansas, zip 71903. Our website is www.LakeHamiltonBibleCamp.com and LHBCOnline.com. There are many free audio files there. It's like going to Bible school at home. This is the 2010 Labor Day Teaching and Deliverance Camp Meeting being held at Lake Hamilton Bible Camp in Hot Springs National Park, Arkansas. This is Thursday evening, September the 2nd, 2010. Colonel Speed Wilson is the speaker of the evening, teaching on World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam. Also, this message had some occasional mic popping, which was beyond our control.
All right, well, it is my privilege tonight to introduce to you Brother Colonel H. Speed Wilson. Speed, it's been 10 years since Speed's been here, and we're so glad that he's chosen to come back again and to be with us. Speed and Glenn have known each other for, 40 years or more, probably, I would imagine. And Speed has been a former Board of Trustees member from Lake Hamilton Bible Camp and is still what Glenn calls an honorary member. I'm going to read just a little bit here, a three-year war veteran, Colonel H. Speed Wilson, U.S. Marine Corps retire, has served our nation in combat in 12 named battles and campaigns during three wars. In recognition of his achievement in battle as a fighter pilot in World War II and Korea, he was awarded 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 16 Air Medals, and 5 Distinguished Combat Unit Awards. During combat duty in Vietnam, he served as Chief of Staff of the 9th Marine Amphibious Brigade, which was an air-ground team of 20,000 Marines. In this assignment, he was awarded the Legion of Merit with a Combat V, and the Republic of Vietnam's Distinguished Service Cross, which is one of the highest decorations awarded to a foreigner. During his 8 years of duty at our nation's capital, Colonel Wilson served on many high-level planning and policy boards and was awarded the Marine Corps Commendation Medal for Meritorious Service. On July 1, 1973, he retired after 31 years as a Marine. You know, we thank Jesus all the time for our freedom. But Brother Speed, thank you for what you've done to maintain the freedom to this nation. Thank you. Brother Speed is going to be speaking tonight on World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam. And we have also at the table back there, he had a book years ago that I don't know how many were in print, but it went out of print. And he's republished it.
About 10,000.
10,000 went out initially. He's republished it as entitled Rapture, A Dangerous Deception. And I confess I have not read it, but I tell you what, Brother Speed spoke back here in the early 80s and spoke it on the rapture. And over 150 scriptures he gave to delineate, to prove against the no rapture. And I tell you, it was one of the best messages I've ever heard on that subject. And so I haven't read the book, but your message has never left me either.
You ought to read it. Glenn's got a good piece in there. It's the origin of the whole thing.
All right, Brother Speed.
If you're fine.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to be talking to pictures right here.
As you say, you can see things. By the way, if you plan to fly and to be in the great flyaway, you'll probably be in the great falling away of what's coming up. Because then we'll be talking on Saturday night, and I would encourage you to bring all your friends that want to know what the heck's going on. And it'll be understanding world events or the manifestation of the new world order. And, we'll take that up tonight. So I'll be talking to the pictures as they change, and afterward, I hope we might be able to take some questions and try to answer. I'd appreciate it if I could get a chair up here. I'm and sit down, one of these, any one of them. Oh, good. Then I can sit over here and have a pointer. I read the other day that there were 16 million served in World War II, and there are only 2 million left. So you're looking at a rare old bird. It's almost an extinguished species. And as I've often said, if I was not going to live to be more than 90 years old, I'd have sure taken better care of myself. So, okay, Tom, let's go. I don't know whether you can see that or not with the lights on, but I hope you can. It's pretty... Can the lights be dimmed any, or at least the ones up here turned off? Hey, that's much better. That's much better. Because this isn't the kind of talk you'll be taking notes, so don't worry about it. Well, most people think that Speed is a nickname. My full name is Harry Speed Wilson. Whatever Tom, Dick, and Harry's named Wilson. So, and no one ever called me Harry except my mother and grandmother. I grew up in West Texas known only as Buck Wilson. And so our family, they claimed the fame of the Speed family. The Speeds and the Murphys came over from Ireland about the same time, and they all settled in and around Louisville, Kentucky. And about half of them went Confederate and half of them Yankee. And so my side of the family chose to go Yankee. Chose to go Confederate. However, Abraham Lincoln's first Secretary of State was Joshua Speed, and his Attorney General was Thomas Speed. And so it got so miserable that my side of the Speed family left Louisville and went to West Texas out here, if you could see it. It's right on the border of the panhandle of Texas on the high plains in a place called Andrews County. Nothing out there. You can look further and see less than any place on the face of the earth. My father died when I was 9 years old, and I went to live with John and Anna Speed on a rather large ranch that they had homesteaded. My mother said she walked all the way from Louisville, Kentucky to Andrews, Texas. That's 1,500 miles. Of course, everybody that could walk did, because you wanted to lighten the loads for the poor old mules that had to pull the wagon. But that's all she remembered. It took 3 months. I've flown that same distance in less than 2 hours. But that was another story. Okay, next one. I joined the Marines, and I was about to finish boot camp at San Diego, and they found that you didn't have to have a college degree to fly an airplane. If you could ride a bicycle and chew gum at the same time, you could probably fly an airplane. So I met the IQ, the intelligence quotient bit, to be able to learn a little bit, and went to pilot training next. And went to Dallas, Texas, actually Grand Prairie, flying the old Stearman. It's painted yellow because you want to warn everybody that's flying around, stay away from this guy. He doesn't know what he's doing. So it's yellow is caution. And so after that, and that was a washout, about one out of three would fail to qualify to go to the next. Okay. And went to Pensacola and flew this one. It's the Vultee VT-1. We call it the Vultee Vibrator. Next one. This is the one we probably flew a whole lot. North American AT-6, the Air Force called it. We call it the SNJ. After we got to where we could fly the airplane and fly formation, then we graduated into the back seat, and they'd pull a hood up over your head so you couldn't see out. And we spent hours under there flying on instruments. Very important, we found out later. Next. And when we graduated from that, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. And so I went out and flew this outfit. This is the F-3F Grumman. And boy, it was quite an airplane. It would go about 150 miles an hour. And the 30-millimeter machine gun fired through the propeller. It was timed so it wouldn't hit the propeller. Well, I was the last class to fly this because we only had four of them, and we were using one for spare parts, and it ran out of spare parts. So I was the last one to fly the old F-3F next. And graduated the 28th of June, 1943, from Pensacola, Florida. And I can point out to Marines that this is the old Corps because we still wore blue cap covers. We don't now. It's all white cap covers. Next. And my daughter fixed this up as here's a tiger, couldn't wait to get into the war. Next. And immediately they were so short of pilots in the Marine Corps that I didn't get the usual 3 to 6 months additional training in a combat type airplane. I went immediately to Hawaii to Marine Corps Air Station Eva and was put in dive bombers, the SBD Douglas Dauntless. Now this airplane is an outstanding airplane. This airplane sank more enemy tonnage than all other Allied airplanes put together. And it was really great. You talk about dive bomber, you can't see it so clear, but it'd carry a 500-pounder here on the belly. And when you're coming straight down, when the airplane is vertical, you're still not coming straight down. You have to get 15 degrees over on your back before you're coming straight down. And so when you're coming straight down, they had to have a yoke on it to throw the bomb clear of the propeller. And I just didn't like that. But you had to put seven bombs in a 50-foot circle, 7 out of 10, and I qualified. And every Friday night when I was about half boozed up, I'd tell the commanding officer what a lousy job I thought this was, flying this outfit. Everybody coming straight down and everybody shooting straight up. It just didn't make much sense to me. So he got a requirement to send some pilots out to Midway. Next. And so there were this group of us, 2, 4, 6, 8 of us, and the one that's taking the picture, that were transferred out to Midway to get into fighter squadron. And look at this bunch, there were only 4 out of us that survived. And went out to Midway, and next one. Went out to Midway and flew the little Grumman Bearcat, or not Bearcat, the little Wildcat. Now this is the one that Joe Foss and many of the others out of Guadalcanal in the early days were flying. And I flew it, got about 30 hours in it. Pretty good little airplane. Next. Then we got the Corsair, the old bent-wing bird. Now, this was the first one that we didn't have bubble canopies. They had straps. We called it the bird cage. Next one. And here's the later Corsair. Big improvement. Big improvement. This is the one we flew some missions in Korea with. Next one. Here's a head-on view of the Corsair. That makes it very unusual. I might mention the Corsair was the first airplane in the world to accelerate in level flight to an excess of 400 miles an hour. And it won all the air races after the war up until about, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Okay, next one. This was our enemy in the air. Was the Japanese Zero, the meatball. Boy, that meatball looks big when it's coming after you. And it was, you never tried to dogfight with these people because they could outmaneuver you no end. You'd meet your maker pretty quick trying to fight with them. You get a shot and then get out of there. But it was lightly armored. In other words, their pilots didn't have armor plate behind them as ours did, and their gas tanks weren't self-sealing. So if you could get a hit on him, you're pretty well going to blow him away. Next one. Now here's what we're working on. If this looks strange to you, this is the way the world really is. It's a non-distorted version of the world. So we were headed after Midway. Now I must say something about Midway. Now I was out there in 1943. In May of 1942, the Battle of Midway took place. And you don't hear much about it, but there are two areas that turned the Pacific. And the Battle of Midway was one, and where I was, the Battle of the Solomon Islands and New Britain was the other. But the Japanese fleet was coming down, and they were going to take Midway Island, Midway meaning it's halfway between Japan and Hawaii. And then, of course, they could really finish up what they started at Pearl Harbor. And by the way, if they had hit the fuel storage at Pearl Harbor, we would have really been in bad shape. But we knew they were coming, and so the Japanese Zero with the drop tank and some of their dive bombers had a much bigger range than ours. In their fleet that was coming down to take Midway, they had 5 aircraft carriers, and all the ships that go with the aircraft carriers they were coming. So the Navy pilots off of the carriers, the dive bombers and torpedo bombers didn't send any fighters. And the ones off of Midway knew, most of them knew, that they would only have enough gasoline to reach the Japanese fleet, but not enough to come home. And torpedo squadron number 8 had one survivor, Ensign Gay from Houston, Texas. Torpedo squadron 6, nobody came home. And Marine dive bomber squadron 421 took off from Midway, knowing they weren't coming back. And it was very interesting. At a reunion years ago, I met Bill Campbell. Everybody that's named Campbell is Soupy Campbell. So I was talking to him, and I asked him, well, what did you feel like and how did they select who was going? He said, well, we had 28 pilots and 24 airplanes, so we put 28 numbers in the hat. The commanding officer and executive officer took number 1 and number 2, because there wasn't going to be a squadron to come home to. And the rest of them, and he said, I drew number 27, so I knew I wasn't going to go. And he said, it was a real strange feeling. First I felt relieved, and then I felt like a coward because I felt relieved. But he said, what was really worse is to see your friends take off the next morning, knowing you weren't going to see them again. And they did. Major Henderson flew his airplane into the deck of one carrier. Now, in dive bombing, once you get on target, you crank your trim tabs forward, so if you're killed, the airplane will still hit your target. Doesn't make any difference to you. You're dead anyhow. And 3 did survive, 2 pilots and 1 rear seat gunner. So that was the Battle of Midway. They sank 4 out of 5 Japanese aircraft carriers and a whole bunch of destroyers and the others. It really hurt them. They lost at least 300 to 400 pilots and 5,000 or 6,000 sailors in the Battle of Midway. And you don't hear a word about it. You talk about kamikazes. Now, we had kamikazes, too. The airfield at Guadalcanal was named Henderson Field after Major Henderson. So here was where we were headed. It's right here in the Solomon Islands, right along in here. Now, you can see Australia, New Zealand. The Japanese had 200,000 troops and support in this area. They were there to invade and occupy Australia, New Zealand. And that's the reason they're there. This whole area, next one. And Guadalcanal is here. And the Japanese main base of Rabaul on the island of New Britain. This was New Ireland. And New Guinea, you can see the tail of New Guinea over here. So this is where the big battle went on. And when you mention Guadalcanal, you usually think of the Marines. Well, the Marines were on land, but the Marines lost about 3,000 to 3,000 or 4,000, but the Navy lost over 5,000 sailors in this area. And they lost 1 admiral and 2 captains. They called it Iron Bottom Straits. There were so many Japanese and American ships in there that were trapped. So they went there. By the time I got there, they were just moving. Marine Fighter Squadron 212 just moving from Guadalcanal over to an island called Vela La Vela. If you ever saw the stupid Bob, the Black Sheep Squadron, the only thing that was authentic and right in that movie or that whole series, they had the right airplane, the tents were the same, but the rest of it was just Hollywood. It had nurses there and all that. The nearest nurses were New Zealand and Australia. And so what we were doing, our airplane was only good for about 800 miles round trip range. So we were trying for the battle for Bougainville, a big place, a big island. And so we were supporting operations. It was hopeless to take Bougainville. About 40,000 Japanese troops were on Bougainville. So we just took a small perimeter, about a 2-mile perimeter along here, finally expanded it to 5 miles, and just left them up in here, and the dive bombers, torpedo bombers, harassing them and that type thing, and the artillery, so forth. Now we could go to Rabaul. And for the first trip to Rabaul, we went from Vela La Vela, landed at the airstrip at Bougainville, refueled, and stood by till the dive bombers, we didn't take them the first missions. And then we took off and headed for Rabaul. Now, the Japanese had 8 airfields right in this area right here. And if they had 50 airplanes on each one, you could see they could put about 400 airplanes in the air. My first mission was the day after Christmas night. Well, it was really between Christmas and it, but the most hairy one I had was the day of Christmas. But November the 28th was my first mission. And there were 28 of us took off, headed, just fighter planes, because we knew very well if we took bombers, we'd lose a lot of bombers. So we were just going up. And it turns out now, from the Japanese records, that they did have 386. Well, that's pretty good guessing that it was 400. They had 386. And so 28 of us ended up over the target. And boy, that was exciting. None of us had, well, there were about 3 or 4 that had seen some combat, but the rest of us had never seen combat. All of these people, the Japanese, had been in the war for 4 years, so they knew what they were doing, and they had a very maneuverable airplane. And it's estimated, as near as we can count, that we were met by about 150 Japanese Zeros, and we were all over the place. And that went on for about a month, grossly outnumbered, up and back and all. And I forget which mission, what I did, but it isn't important. There were only 2 second lieutenants in the squadron, and I was one of them because we went out so quickly. And the other one was Bob Hutchison. He's the one that took the pictures of the rest of us. And so he and I, the junior officers, if you don't know fighter tactics, they fly in sections of 2. The leader is up front. He's the experienced one, and the other one that flies wing is to protect him and keep other planes from shooting. He does the shooting, you do the protecting. So as second lieutenants, we flew wing on the captains and majors. And in that capacity, in the Marine Corps, you have to have a witness that before you can be credited with a kill or a victory, you have to see the airplane blow up, you have to see the pilot bail out or crash in the ocean or on the water. And there has to be a witness to it. There's none of this stuff of just shooting at them and claiming them. So at the end of our first 6 weeks, and it was time to be pulled out, and another squadron replace us, at the end of the 6 weeks, we started out with 32 pilots. We had 16 now. We'd lost half our pilots. But we'd shot down by confirmation 87 Japanese fighter airplanes, and 54 probables. That means we hit them, but we don't know whether they went down or not. My experience was on my 5th mission, a Zero swept by and just really shattered me. And I could look out the wing and knocked out my radio. I couldn't communicate. And I could see oil coming out of my oil coolers in the wing roots. And so I knew I wasn't going to be airborne very long before the engine had quit. So I headed away, and the engine finally quit running somewhere along in here. It just seized. It got so hot the paint on the cowling was melting and that sort of thing. And so I crash landed in the ocean. We call it ditching. And you say, well, why didn't you bail out? Well, the reason we didn't bail out, all of our parachutes were rotten. Up there on Bougainville, the actual rainfall is about 140 inches a year. You lay down and take a nap, and you wake up, and you're growing fungus out of your ears, nose, and armpits, everywhere else. So I got along in here before it seized, and I ditched, but I forgot to lock my harness in all the excitement, and my face ended up in the instrument panel, and my left eyelid was severed and was just hanging down. I couldn't close my eyelid, and I could pick bone fragments out of my nose. It was all shattered. And I could stick my tongue through my upper lip. That gave me something to do while I was waiting. So I spent 3 days and 2.5 nights in a little rubber boat right along about here. Little rubber boat's just big enough for your rear end. Your feet stick out the other end. Boy, the days were long, but boy, those nights, I thought they'd never end. Now, I had a signal mirror, but the planes going up here, I was signaling that at them, but they weren't looking down. They were looking up because the Japanese usually came in high. But on the 3rd day, and by the way, I promised God if he'd get me out of that mess, I'd go to church. And I thought that's what made you a Christian. So On the third day, there was a transport somewhere off along here, but I could still see him. And he had his four-plane escort. He's going to the Admiralty Islands, which are up here, because I'd escorted the transport once up there. And they saw my mirror and reported it. And midnight of the third night, a submarine surfaced. And he was flashing his searching around. I didn't know whether it was an American submarine or a Japanese, but I was glad to see anybody. So I already had a clip of tracers on the old 45. I started firing those tracers, and they came over and picked me up. And 3 days later, I was back at Bougainville. And they stitched my face up and all that sort of thing. And I was grounded for 10 days for a face to heal. And I thought, well, I better look up the chaplain. I'll keep my promise to God that I'll go to church. So I finally found the chaplain's tent on Bougainville. But the tent flap was closed, wasn't there, and he had a handwritten sign on it that says, "Take your troubles to Jesus, the chaplain's on rest and recuperation." Well, I didn't know how to do that. By the way, I did finally meet the Lord. We'll get to that in 1958 and 59. But then they pulled us out and reformed. We got replacements. We went down to Australia for 12 days, rest and recuperation. Boy, it was really great. Now, the Australians, all of their armed forces, remember, they were part of the United Kingdom. And England had been in war for a long time, so all the armed forces of Australia and New Zealand had come around in 1938 and 39 and were protecting and fighting the battles in Europe and Africa. So they didn't have any down there. Now the Australians, you could either go to Australia for 2 weeks or you could go to New Zealand for 2 weeks, and I chose to go to Australia, most did. And they really appreciated it because they told us when we were going down there, all you had to do to go to any private club that you wanted to, and there are a lot of beautiful private clubs, and be in uniform. Of course, you had to wear a uniform all the time anyhow. And to go in, and they'd feed you, and you'd get all you could drink and everything, and they wouldn't let you pay for a dime. Not a bit. And they kidded us a whole lot about it because we'd step off the curb looking for the traffic in the wrong direction. It was over here, and they'd always shout, "Get your head out, Yank!" But anyway, to make it real, it was really great. They just treated us so nicely. But there were seven of us decided we ought to get a little culture, so we decided we'd go to the opera. We saw Madame Butterfly. But what a blessing. When we walked into the theater, it got real quiet. Of course, we're all in uniform. And when it was time for the curtain to go up, instead of playing God Save the Queen or King, they played the Marine Corps hymn. Then they played God Save the Queen. I had the chance to go down there for another purpose during the Vietnam operation. I'd never been to Canberra, their capital. Beautiful city, built around a great big lake. There's no private property there. The only homes that are there, you can lease land for 100 years with an option to renew, but you can't own it, and that way they can control it. And there are two main buildings around this lake that had a water spout in the middle of the lake that was out in front of it. It goes up about 100 or 200 feet high, beautiful. And between their State Department and their War Department, there was a beautiful monument like Washington's monument. And on the top, I looked at it, and I recognized it was a United States Federal Eagle on the top. So I walked over and looked at the base, and this is what it said. "This is dedicated to the Americans who died that we might live in freedom." That's the only monument in Canberra. So they knew what was going on. So then after 12 weeks, we came back, and back to Bougainville. No, we didn't go. We went to Bougainville for about a week and then moved up to a very small island up here called Green Island. It was 5 miles long and a mile wide. But the war had moved on up into the Central Pacific up in here. They abandoned, and they must, we couldn't determine the records, but they had to have left behind 150 to 200,000 people in the island right now because they couldn't get them out. If we have time, I'll tell you how I earned one Distinguished Flying Cross there. Tell you war stories. But now the second time I got shot up, this was in our first tour before we went to our first R&R rest and recuperation. The second time I was hit, same way, one just went by and sprayed me, but I could still talk and I could still communicate. So I switched over to guard channel, which is emergency. And by this time, the Navy had a PBY, the old Catalina amphibious, and he would hold off out here about 100 miles. And because the dive bombers, torpedo bombers, and others were really taking a lot of hits. And so I called him on guard channel and told him my predicament, my engine was going to quit probably in about 30 to 45 minutes. And he said, well, I'm off Cape St. George. That's Cape St. George right there, a big radar station and a lot of anti-aircraft there. Anti-aircraft fire, big stuff. I'd seen Swede Larsen blown completely out of the air. I was flying by, and I looked back, and he wasn't there, and I looked in the rearview mirror. It was just a black puff where he used to be. And so I said, yeah, I know where Cape St. George is. He said, well, I have a torpedo bomber and a dive bomber down over here. I'm busy picking them up. And would sure appreciate it if you get as close as you can. So I headed that way and finally spotted them. And so I put it in the water not too far from them, and they taxied over and picked me up. And the rear seat gunner and the dive bomber died before we got back to Bougainville. And the next time I got shot up, it wasn't the oil, but when I got back to Bougainville, I couldn't get my landing gear down. I knew the hydraulic pressure was zero, so I knew it had been hit there. But we thought usually could force the gear down by jiggling it up and down, but I couldn't. I only had about 10 more minutes of fuel. And the tower, I told him my problem, but he had dive bombing torpedo people that were hurt, and they were having to take them aboard, and they only had the one strip. And if I came in, I'd foul up the strip, and people, well, it was just a priority. And so I asked the tower, what the heck should I do with this airplane? I can't tell what he said, but the general idea was that was my problem. So I'd gotten pretty good at water landings. So I just put it down about 100 yards off the beach, waded ashore. There was a sailor on the beach sunbathing. He looked up and says, where in the hell did you come from? I said, Rival. And he looked at me like I was crazy. They sent a Jeep out, picked me up. So that was that. And that was it. Oh, I shot down two, and should have been accredited with another one, but I shot them down. There's nothing to it. I was flying wing on a cap. By the way, I confirmed 12 kills on other people that I was flying wing on, but I was flying on a Captain Horner. And I was busy watching him as we were coming around. And he said, take him, Speed. I looked up and there was one in front, and I pressed the trigger and he blew up. Another time, we were coming around in a big, heavy, steep turn. And one just came, I don't know where he came from. I just happened to look back and there he was and gave him a squirt and he blew up. So it was no big deal. But one got on my tail and I just couldn't get the rascal off. So, because we could out-dive them, there were a few things. You could go into an uncontrolled maneuver. I did that once. Uncontrolled means you don't know what the airplane's going to do, so he ain't going to know either. You just get it in a steep turn, kick the top rudder, and jerk back on the stick, and the airplane goes all through a bunch of crazy stuff, and you lose him. But this one, I knew that the zero, their controls would freeze up at around 300 or 400 miles an hour. So we just rolled over and split us away from them and then come back up and try to get them. And I rolled over and this one just kept coming. He just kept coming. I could see him in the rearview mirror and his tracers were going by and occasionally I was getting hit. And I suddenly realized, I started at about 15,000 feet, and I suddenly realized, man, you're going to hit the water. And I looked, and sure enough, the water was there, and I horsed back on it and pulled up. And, of course, all the blood drained out of my head, and I blacked out. That was pretty common. All the blood drains out of your brain, and you just lose vision, and you black out. And sometimes, it seems like you're out for a long time. You begin to wake up, and you wonder, where in the heck am I? What's this all stuff about? And then you come too quick sometimes. But when I came to, I was going straight up, And I rolled over, looked back. He didn't make it. He hit the water. It was just a greasy spot with fire. He made it. But if I'd been in the Air Force, that would have been my third kill. But the Marine Corps, I didn't shoot him down. I just outran him. He just killed himself. So after that, I came home. The next slide. Came home and was assigned to Marine Corps Air Station Iwakuni, for Cherry Point, flying in an engineering squadron, which had a lot of airplanes. Remember, in those days, we didn't have helicopters. If you went down at sea, you had to have an amphibian that could land on both land, have the landing gear here, and you'd land in the ocean and pick them up. So I was checked out, and this is the Grumman Goose. Interesting airplane. Next one. As the Piper Cubs. It's strange that I'd gotten up into flying jet airplanes and never flew a Piper Cub. But we used these in Korea for air evacuation, and of course they're used for observation and all sorts. Okay, next one. And this was an interesting airplane for you airplane enthusiasts. This is the Beech Stagger Wing Beech. You can see that the bottom wing sticks out beyond the top wing. And if you just sit there and keep it straight and level, it wouldn't spin. It would just yo-yo down. And the top wing would fly, and it would stall, and the bottom would stall. And then it just yo-yo down on the whole thing. Carries six passengers. Quite a nice airplane. Next one. And then the old duck. The other second lieutenant, spent 2 days in the water, and he was picked up by a duck. Brought him home. Next one. Then the Widgeon, that's the only inline engine I ever flew, was the Widgeon, a Grumman Widgeon, nice little airplane. Next. Now here was a real challenge, besides the Corsair. The Corsair was a real challenge. The only reason the Marine Corps got the Corsair is because the Navy couldn't handle them on carriers, because the right wing stalled 5 knots sooner than the other one, and so you'd flip it over on its back. And the other one was, you couldn't make a full stall landing. It would stall before you ever got it in 3-point, and the hook wouldn't hook. So they gave it to the Marine Corps. So it turned out. But this one was really something. The B-26, the people over in Europe, this was a bomber that was faster than some of the fighters. In fact, it had the lowest number of planes lost per sortie, per mission flown, because it would fly low and faster than some of the German fighter planes. And we used it to tow targets because it could go 300 miles an hour pretty easy. We'd reel out 1,500 feet of cable behind it with a target on it so that the ground people could shoot at it. And I really enjoyed flying this. That was the first co-pilot thing. Okay, next one. This was the airplane only the Marine Corps had, the F-7F Tiger Cat. Henry Miller, if you watch the Black Sheep Squadron thing, Pappy Boyington, he was 32 years old. Anybody that's 32 years old is ancient, because I was 22. And so they called him Pappy. He was just an alcoholic bum. And the guy that ran the squadron was Henry Miller, Major Henry Miller. Because we were on the same island with 214, the Black Sheep. Ours was the Hellhounds, 212. We were on the same island. And it's a shame that they get the image of the Marine Corps pilots from some drunken bum, but he did, and the reason you hear of him so much is because their public relations officer was a public relations man in New York, so he got all publicity. But anyway, Henry Miller got the commission to form a squadron of these day fighters. Had the same engines, of course, there, but had two of them and only weighed a third more. So it had, at maximum power, had 5,000 horsepower. Boy, what a deal. The old Corsair, the nose stuck out here 8 feet. You feel like you're riding on the tail end of a telephone pole. But this one, you couldn't even see the nose. It just, you could have to stand up to look and see it. You had a clear view, and it would climb almost straight up. It was designed to get off of a base on the ground and get to altitude and shoot down the Japanese bombers real quick. And it had 4 50-caliber machine guns in the nose and 2 20-millimeter cannons in each wing, 4 of them. And each of those cannons fired a 3/4-pound round, and they could do it 600 rounds a minute. Boy, they just blast anything. I could get into the load and all that sort of thing. So Henry Miller had known me out at Vela Lavella and the other places. And my roommate was a 214 rope trick Loesch, Freddie Loesch. and so, and another roommate on the other side, Jimmy Watson. So he could pick any pilots he wanted at Cherry Point. So he chose the three of us plus others that had been with him. And we were in the process of going overseas, and it was so close that all of our gear was on board the aircraft carrier and we were getting on. But we were, I don't need to get all the details, but we were having a little problem with the cannons, because the muzzle blast on the cannon, every time you fired the canopy would fly off. So that wasn't too smart. So we added muzzle blast dampeners, and that solved that problem. So we were coming back from a night mission of strafing at night out in the desert, and they called us and said at about midnight, the war is over. And so then I had to make a choice. The Marine Corps gave us a choice to either go take your overseas orders, or you could stay at home on a point system. And I could stay at home because I had more than enough points to stay at home. But if I wanted to get out, I'd have to get into the reserves and be eligible for recall. So the next one. Oh, this is Cherry Point where we were. Now, any of you aviators in here, I don't know why we don't build airports like this. You have all your administrative buildings here and your aircraft parking areas down in here. Of course, you could put them over in here and over here and over here. And when you want to take off, you taxi right out to the center and take off. When you land here and come to the center. Isn't that simple? And you don't have to taxi around all over Texas or Georgia to get there. I think the people that build the airfields have an interest in concrete and petroleum fuel to run you around. In fact, I had the old B-26, the brakes failed, so I landed here and coasted out and got here in Dogleg and had total 7,000 feet here. If you can't get it stopped in 14,000 feet, you ought to go plow something. But so that was the Cherry Point. Beautiful field. Next. This is the love of my life. Staff Sergeant Ruth Heller. She was an air traffic control tower operator. What a wonderful lady. And they had to have a pilot in the tower at all times, and that's where I met her. She was from Akron, Ohio. Next one. Here's the tower at Cherry Point. Next one. And so when we chose to get out, Ruth and I talked it over and decided we would get out and go to the University of Texas. Because we tried to get in other places, but being a Texan, the states were only taking the GI Bill of their state residents. So she became a naturalized Texan. So it was pretty, we had it easy because we were both on the GI Bill, but we still had to watch our money. And so I was in my last semester. Well, flip it again. We'll go next one. Here she was in her senior year. What a beautiful girl. She was elected Blue Bonnet Queen, 1950, in her senior year. And her academics were so great that she was awarded the science honorary thing for domestic science. And it was so great in the related field that she was also inducted into the Architectural Honors Society. That's the first time that had ever been done. And her grade point was so high that her name was put in bronze. We were back there 30 years later, and only two other names had been added that equaled that. So that was my Ruth. She taught here. She really is a wonderful Bible teacher. Her message was to say who God says you are, the world will say you're arrogant. Amen. But to deny who God says you are is really super arrogant. You're not calling God a liar when you deny who you are. You're an offshoot. You're the body of Christ. And you know who you are. Read the book. You're an overcomer, not a copper outer. Okay, next one. And here's what we were flying at Dallas. We go up there 1 weekend a month and get 4 days' pay. I always thought that was great, getting paid to do something I would pay to do. It was a new airplane, a lot of improvements. Okay, next one. Now, we had just finished our 2 weeks active duty, and I came back from Cherry Point to 2 weeks active duty, signed up to finish my Last, I needed 12 hours of government and history and corporate finance to get my degree in mechanical engineering. And there was a telegram on the door that says to report immediately to Naval Air Station Dallas for extended active duty. 30 days later, I was in Japan. And so here we were flying out of Japan into Korea and the Busan perimeter here. And because I had flown the F-7F, they had converted the F-7F. They took the four machine guns out of the nose and put a radar antenna in there and took 100 gallons of gasoline from behind the pilot and put a radar operator back there and made it an all-weather night fighter type thing. So we flew all the missions from sundown to sunup, and when the weather was so bad nobody could fly, we flew. We always had targets because the communists would move at night and in bad weather. At the Pusan perimeter, we were doing close air support at night, and that's pretty scary when you're going down below mountaintops at night. Only reason we could do it is because the radar operator could see the terrain on his scope. We were flying out of a place here called Irizuki, near the city of Fukuoka across here. And then shortly thereafter, the Incheon landing up here, we covered that, and I hit a ammunition dump and a gun placement up there and blew the side out of a mountain. We got in there. MacArthur cut it off and trapped the North Koreans and some other people down in here, and that started the whole operation. Okay, next. Now, here's what Korea really looked like. The first was down at Pusan, and here's the Yalu River up here, and Vladivostok, Russia, is right along about here. And so, and I think, well, anyway, we got up to the 38th parallel, which is right along about here, and we didn't know what to do. So we stood down, no missions, no nothing, for 10 days till the United Nations could determine what we were supposed to do. Now, the South Korean army didn't stop. They kept going. And so they were up and along here before. But after 10 days, order came to reunite the Republic of Korea. So that meant going to the Yalu River. So we jumped off, and that was in October, started clobbering them and that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden, flying missions up here at night, and I wrote my wife letters. We could see Chinese coming across, see their trucks coming across at night, and they had their headlights on. MacArthur would not allow us to hit them. MacArthur would not allow us to hit them. Now we know why. He wanted to get the Chinese into it, so an excuse to hit China and take care of them now. That day will come. While we're expending all of our wealth and everything in a place that we shouldn't even be, over in the Middle East, and when we've used it all up, China will move to take that area, and there'll be nothing we can do about it. So hang on, it's going to be a hairy ride. So, all of a sudden, with the Chinese coming in, and I forget the exact day, but anyway, they admitted that the Chinese would really come in. Of course, Ray Davis, the lieutenant colonel, battalion commander up in here from above the Chosin Reservoir, he said when they were saying that the Chinese would not come in, he had 186 dead bodies frozen and laying up for a windbreak, Chinese. Now, up at the Chosin Reservoir, that was beginning the end of November, and it went till Christmas Day of 1950. And the normal temperature up there at 7,000 feet above sea level, the Siberian Desert up in here, and the average temperature at night was 40 below zero, and one night it got 60 below. And the warmest it got in the whole time was 10 below. Now, you try to service airplanes in weather like that, but God forgive us for what the ground marines went through. Frostbite and all of that. And the Chinese were just all over the place. Everywhere. And finally, they had to admit they were in. And so then we started after them. And 23 days in the Chosin Reservoir, and finally we were able to get the Marines out. The 1st Marine Division was trapped up there. We didn't ever think we'd see them again, because there was two Chinese divisions to the north two onto the west and two to the east, and about three divisions on their only way out down the road down here, coming down off of the plateau from the reservoir. But we started, and there's one humorous one, Chesty Puller. If you're a Marine, you've heard of him. The guy had four Navy crosses, nine Purple Hearts, and heaven only knows how many Silver Stars. But he was a regimental commander. And when they briefed him on it, says, and just what I just told you, all the Chinese, and they said, "Well, Colonel Puller, what do we do now?" He stood up. He only stood about 5'8". And he says, "Well, the bastards won't get away this time." In other words, anyway we go, we got Chinese, so we'll get them. That was the attitude they came. So we gave close air support. Everybody started flying round the clock to get them out. 23 days later, we finally got them out, got them down to Hung Nam, got them aboard ship, and evacuated, I think the estimate was 150,000 Koreans that were friends to us that we couldn't leave behind, and came out. We went back to Japan, start all over, come back up, and still in night fighters from K1 at Pusan, and flying out of here. Many flashbacks come, but my job was, the assignment mainly at this time was just to patrol the Yalu River. Now, this was in June, the 28th of June, I was patrolling the Yalu River. Now, when we took off from Pusan, we could hardly see the end of the runway to take off. So we were on instruments from the time we took off till we got up here, and we were at about 18,000 feet, and we were patrolling the Yalu River, turning around 50 miles away from Vladivostok so we wouldn't get the Russians after us, and come back around and up at this bend, turn around and go back to keep enemy airplanes from coming down. Right along about here, now that we didn't know there was any heavy aircraft up, anti-aircraft up there, but we got three bursts, one right in front of me, one right behind me, and the other one must have been right under us, because I don't know what happened to the airplane. I think it was blown over on its back. But I finally got it righted by the instruments, got it flying right side up. My canopy was blown away, and so was the canopy on my radar operator, Tech Sergeant Leonard Lang. But he had his right hand torn off at the wrist, but he had gotten some wire tied around it and got the blood cut off. And so it was really, and the right engine was gone. All I had was one engine left, and even straight and level and heading back down this direction, I was coming down at 400 feet with full power on the 400 feet a minute. Now, I'd been talking, I still had radio, I'd been talking to a Navy destroyer who was off out here somewhere and told him what my predicament, and he had me on his scope. He had us all the time. And I said, "Would you please see if you can get us around the mountains up here and get us down to the nearest water, which I assume is Wonsan." Well, Wonsan was held by the communists at that time. We'd been in Wonsan before, and all the signs at Wonsan were in Russian. And and all the talk over here in the MiG alley was all spoken by Russian. So there were Russian pilots, fighter pilots, fighting our pilots over there. And so we're coming on down at 3:30 in the morning. I finally touched down here, never saw the water, just kept coming down at 400 feet a minute. And when my radio altimeter said I was at 30 feet, I just loosed the nose up and splashed her in the water. And got Sergeant Lang into his little riverboat. I got into my little riverboat, tied them together. Sun started coming. Thank God it was 28th of June, so the water was warm. It wasn't going to freeze. And so the sun started coming up, and they spotted us over here on the shore, and they started shooting at us, but they couldn't reach us. But as near as we could tell, the tide was going in, so that wasn't good news. And they started coming around the corner with something that looked like a Jeep. And I recognized what they had behind it. They had one of these 23-millimeter cannons, twin barrels. You've seen them on there. They go boom, 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 boom. And well, they make a hole about 2 inches big when they go in, but they blow a hole about that big coming out. And Sergeant Lang says, "You know, Captain, as soon as they get that thing on its base plate, these bolts are going to spring a lot of leaks." I said, "Yep, I'm afraid you're right, Leonard." But just about the time they got it ready and was sitting down on the seat to crank, there was a big boom over the horizon. And glory to God, here came the destroyer. And he had 2 5-inch cannons up front. Now it was their time to run. And he got a few of them on the beach that didn't run in time. So he pulled around and got between us and them and got us aboard, docked to Pusan. Sergeant Lang came home, retired to disability. Now, after you're flying 75 night and all weather missions, you could make a choice of taking a ground job or continue to fly missions, but you had to go before the commanding officer and make a choice. Well, when I hit 75, I didn't say anything because I saw some of the jobs that aviators get when you're grounded. So on my 89th mission, I was shot down. So they grounded me and took me out of the squadron, put me in the intelligence branch. Debriefing, that is, when the night fighters would come back, my job was to find out what they did, what they saw, where they saw it, all that sort of thing. I did that for about a month. And then intelligence, I also had the opportunity to sit in on debriefing prisoners to find out what good. Now, this is the way we did it in Korea. You can't get by. I think it would still work in the Middle East. None of that waterboarding stuff. You'd have usually a Marine Corps captain sitting there in a uniform, in his field uniform with his captain bars on, and there'd also be an interpreter, a Korean, quite often an enlisted man in the South Korean. But over in the corner, you'd have a great big Korean Marine, a ROK, R-O-K, Republic of Korea, ROK Marine, and he's standing there with a pistol on each hip and glowering at the prisoner, you know. Because he's probably had his mother or somebody else killed by these communist rascals. And the captain would tell him, "Now, you can answer my questions and answer them truthfully, or I'll get up and leave here, and he will take over the questions. Now, will you answer my questions?" "You bet." They're ready to talk because they don't want to turn it over to him, because we're going to get out of there and we wasn't going to witness what was going to take place. You didn't have to waterboard, just turn them over. The others worked fine. But after about a month of that, they decided that they needed a provost marshal up at Seoul. We had an advanced base up there for operations, just across the Yon River from Seoul, the capital. So in the base, my home base was down here. So I was up there, took charge of about 1,500 military police, Marines. We were supposed to keep law and order in Seoul, the capital up there. And my friends all said, "Old Speed's now the sheriff up at Seoul." And it was an interesting job. Next slide. That's the F-7F. Changed, has the cockpit, and it's night fighter, all the letters and so forth. Next one. And so, because my main base was back down at Pusan and I was up at Seoul, they gave me an old torpedo bomber to liaison between the two places to make the bases. And I had never flown it, so I just read the handbook, got in and fly it. Flew like a truck. And it had a normal crew of a pilot, a top gunner, a tail gunner, and a navigator radio operator in the belly. And its internal bomb bay carried quite a bit. And we called it the Turkey because it flew like a truck. But I did find out by putting a cargo net in the bomb bay, I could carry 100 cases of beer in there. But not a bit of humor. Because I was up at Seoul, so we'd go to the Army over at Seoul at the racetrack, their headquarters. And I could show them my orders that I had 1,200 Marines over at Yongdongpo. And so I would draw a ration for 1,200 there. Then I'd go over to Incheon, to the Navy, and draw a ration for 1,200 there. And then, of course, getting the ration from Pusan. Well, you say you get a bunch of drunk policemen. No. See, they cut it down to 3.2 beer. You can't get drunk on 3.2 beer. You can overwork your kidneys, but you just can't get drunk on this stuff. So, but it is okay. So, I had a wonderful experience. This Chesty Puller, what a guy. He wanted to go up and see in the punch bowl. If I could land up there, he wanted to go to the punch bowl and be there himself. So they asked me if I would see if I could do it. So I flew up to the punch bowl and landed on the dirt strip up there in this old turkey. And the next morning he showed up and he got in and introduced himself. What a character. I wish I could tell you something. The newspapers were always after him because they always said, well, why didn't you give the guy the Medal of Honor? I said, well, every other word was a curse word. And he'd have to go to the White House to get it, and he'd embarrass the Marine Corps, so they never would give him the Medal of Honor. But he always told the truth. And so I went up and found I could do it, and took it up, and came back. And so then, that's where I finished my tour of duty as Sheriff of Seoul, and came back to the States. Okay, next one. Came back, very interesting, my wife was born and raised at Canal Fulton. It's a small farming community outside Akron. Akron's main side. And came back. And she, by the way, my daughter was born during the Chilcotin Reservoir. Can you imagine? They were having big snow at Akron at that time, but she didn't have the heart to write to tell me that they were having trouble with snow when I was at the Chilcotin Reservoir, sleeping in a horse stable in a sleeping bag and flying day and night all the way through. Freezing to death. Some of our pilots were so frozen when they got back they had to put them into tents and heat them and thaw them out. My radar operator was so cold that they had to help him out of the cockpit. My heels froze, frostbit was setting them in the rudder with the pressure on the heels. I didn't know they were hurt till I stepped on them, and boy, I thought the top of my head was coming off. But anyway, Ruth said, well, where are we going to be stationed? I said, Akron. She said, you got to be kidding. Akron, what's at Akron? Well, out at the big blimp hangar, there was a Naval Air Station Akron, and they had a squadron of F-8F Bearcat Marine Reservists, and there were 27 of them, and my job was to get them ready to go to Korea. Now, this was a real airplane. This is the Bearcat, same engine as the Corsair, 2,500 horsepower maximum, but it weighed a third less.
This is the end of Part A. Please play Part B. Our website is www.LakeHamiltonBibleCamp.com and LHBCOnline.com. There are many free audio files there. It's like going to Bible school at home. Thank you.